Thanks for tuning in to the Thirst for More podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Smitley. Thirst for More podcast was created to help strength and conditioning coaches, personal trainers, fitness enthusiasts, and anyone that loves lifting heavy shit all be connected under one roof. We take deep dives into coaching, programming and training, running gyms, nutrition, and overall improving your knowledge in the field of strength and conditioning. If you're new here, I'm glad you're able to tune in and hope you can just take away one awesome piece of information today to help you along with your journey. If you're a returning supporter, I appreciate you being along for the ride. Now let's dive into today's episode. Here's what nobody in this industry wants to admit, that the cutting edge training methods that your favorite influencer is selling you right now. Half of them were invented by a Soviet sports scientist in 1964. The other half were pioneered by a guy wrestling alligators in Florida in the 1970s. And that revolutionary progressive OVO concept that every certification is teaching us, well, a Greek wrestler figured it out 2,500 years ago by carrying a calf on his shoulders every day until it grew into a bull. Now, strength training didn't just appear in the last decade, right? It has a history, a long, messy, fascinating history, really full of breakthroughs, scams, dead ends, and genuine revolutions. And if you don't know that history, you're going to keep falling for rebranded old ideas being sold to you as new discoveries. So today, we're doing something a little bit different here today on the podcast. We're tracing the entire evolution of strength training from ancient Greece to now AI-driven programming so that you can understand where this field has been, where it's headed, and where you fit maybe as a coach, trainer, athlete, or maybe even a gym owner. Because the people who know the history are the ones who stop chasing the trends, and they're going to start building the real expertise. So let's dive into today's episode. What's up? Welcome back to the Thirst for More podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Smitley. And today's episode is one that I've been wanting to talk about for quite some time, and that's the evolution of strength training and where we've been with it, so the history of it, where we currently are in the industry, and where it could be going, where I happen to see it going. And this is why I think this episode is important, is that I talk to a lot of different young coaches, young athletes, people coming up in the field, just me on social media as well, who think that strength training started with like something like CrossFit, or maybe they think that Mike Mentzer invented HIIT, you know, just from hearing it recently on a podcast, or they think their hypertrophy research began with Dr. Mike Isertel. Now, I will admit that I have massive respect for all those names and all those people. I'm not shaming them. It's just that a lot of people think that's where a lot of this information initially started. But at the end of the day, they're really standing on the shoulders of giants who have worked hundreds of years ago, and there's hundreds of years worth of work that they're kind of basing a lot of this on. And when you don't know that, right, you end up chasing every new shiny object on Instagram or TikTok, thinking that it's revolutionary when it's actually a rerun of information that we've probably already known for quite some time. And so my goal by the end of the episode is that I'm going to give you a timeline that you can place around any training method that you might happen to be into. So you're going to know who actually the innovators were. You're going to be able to be better equipped to filter the noise that you're seeing over there on the social medias. And because the noise, in my opinion, is only getting louder as the social medias continue to grow, the algorithms continue to change, right? They're showing the high click-through rate, the high watch times, right? They may not actually even be providing sometimes the best overall information. So let's start here from the very beginning. Now, 6th century BC in Greece, there's a wrestler named Milo of Croton, 6-time Olympic champion, arguably the most famous athlete of his era. And the legend goes that when Milo was a young man, he picked up a newborn calf and carried it on his shoulders every single day. The calf grew, Milo grew, and by the time that calf was a full-size bull, Milo was the one carrying the bull. That is progressive overload. 2,500 years ago, a Greek wrestler figured out the foundational principle of strength training before the concept of the barbell was even invented or existed. Now, is the Milo story literally true in the way that it's told and that it's passed on? You know, probably not, right? But here's what we do know is that the ancient Greeks had a formalized system of physical training built around athletic performance, right? We know that they had gymnasiums, they had coaches, they had weight stones called halters and jumpers used for both swinging in mid-flight and for just general strength training. And the Romans continued and expanded this tradition. And then India had its own strength culture with the Indian club, the Gada, the wrestling traditions that are still alive today that we know them as. And the point is that the core principles of strength training at the end of the day are really actually pretty ancient. You apply stress, you recover, you adapt, and then you apply more stress. And the principle is just general biology, right? It's not just something that we randomly discover just on a whim doing some random research. It's as old as the first human who noticed that they got stronger from putting in hard physical work. But formalized, programmed, systematic-based strength training, the thing that we currently do today in our standard gyms, is definitely much more recent, right? And to understand it, we have to jump forward about 2,300 years into the late 1800s. Now, in the late 1800s to early 1900s, this is the age of physical culture, and the godfather of this whole era is a name named Eugene Sandow. Probably heard of that name before. Sandow was a German strongman who became essentially the world's first fitness influencer. He toured Europe and America. He performed feats of strength on stage. He posed in tights to show off his physique. And I think this is really the important piece here from all this is that he sold systems, books, mail order training programs, dumbbells stamped with his name. He's on the cover of the first major bodybuilding magazine that we have. He's what the Mr. Olympia trophy is modeled after, which is probably why you know that name. The Sandow built the template for the modern fitness industry back in 1895. And after him came waves of strongmen. So we have Arthur Saxon, who could do a bent press with something like 370 pounds, still the unofficial record over a century later. We got Louis Crying George Hackschmidt, who wrote one of the first real strength training manuals, and by the way, invented why you can just guess by the name, the hack squat. But the real institutional turn came in the 1930s and the 1940s when Bob Hoffman and York Barbell came around. Yeah, probably recognize those names. Hoffman built the first major American strength training company, and he published Strength and Health magazine. He funded and coached the U.S. Olympic weightlifting team for decades. And for a good chunk of the mid-20th century, if you wanted barbells, you bought them from York. And if you wanted training information, you read Hoffman. He was the gatekeeper at the time with all the stuff. Now, was a lot of Hoffman's advice flawed by today's standards that we have in the industry? Absolutely, right? Science is going to evolve. That's just generally any field. But he pushed his own protein supplements with shaky claims. He was rigid about Olympic lifting being superior to everything else, but he institutionalized strength training in America. And before Hoffman, it was a circus act for the most part. After Hoffman, it was a legitimate pursuit with magazines, competitions, governing bodies, and creating what we really like to call now a culture. And I want you to try to hold on to this lesson, because it's going to repeat a couple different times. Someone institutionalizes, you know, some kind of discipline, and that becomes the default voice. And then the science catches up and questions some of what they were teaching. And that cycle never stops in this industry. It's just everlasting. It didn't stop then. And I don't see it stopping anytime soon when it comes to everything that we're doing here in the industry. Now, the 1970s gave us one of the most controversial and the most influential figures in the history of strength training, a guy named Arthur Jones. And Jones was known for being eccentric. He kind of flew on his own planes. He wrestled alligators. He had an actual ranch with exotic animals, and he invented the Nautilus machines. You've probably seen and heard of these if you've been around for any period of time. And if you've ever used a selectorized machine with a cam-based pulley system, you can thank Arthur Jones for that. But Jones didn't just sell his machines. He sold a philosophy called high-intensity training, or as many of us know in the industry, as HIIT. And the idea was that one set of an exercise taken to absolute muscular failure, performed once or twice a week, was optimal for muscle growth. It was brief and frequent, but it was very brutal. And he published this in his Nautilus training bulletins, which if you've ever read them, if you've never read them, excuse me, you should go find them. But if you have read them, they are definitely very intriguing. And they are still some of the most provocative and entertaining training that's ever been published. I've seen a couple of them, and they're pretty interesting. But HIT has its believers, right? A very popular one that we all probably know of the name is Mike Mincer. And he took this mainstream into the bodybuilding with Heavy Duty. And then Dorian Yates won 6 Mr. Olympia titles using a version of HIT. And Ellington Darden built a whole career teaching Jones's principles. Now, at the same time, and even the same decade, the bodybuilding world was exploding, but in a completely different direction. We had people like Arnold Schwarzenegger, Franco Colombo, Frank Zane, the good old golden era of bodybuilding. And we also had the Wilder principles. Joe and Ben Wilder, built an empire around muscle magazines, supplements, and the Mr. Olympia contest. And their methods were the opposite of HIIT. They were very pro high volume, multiple exercises per body part, training body parts twice a week, sometimes even more. So here we had this almost civil war in regards to training. We had HIIT versus volume, machines choosing free weights, complete failure versus moderate effort, and it raged back and forth for decades, and you can still argue that it still does to this day. And here to me is what I find comical about all this, is that the research that we have now suggests the truth is somewhere in the middle. Just like with most stuff, it's usually, when we look on the spectrum from white to black, most things are usually going to fall in the gray. And as we know in our field, many people say it depends. And it does depend on a lot of stuff when it comes to training. Volume does matter. Intensity does matter. Frequency does matter. You don't need to train to failure on every single set, but you do need to train close to failure some of the time. This is essentially what Brad Schoenfeld and the modern hypertrophy research community has been confirming for the last 15 years now. Both sides of that war had pieces of the truth. Neither one necessarily was completely right and the other one was completely wrong. And I hope you can take that away here, that shade of gray, because that's really going to be the theme of the rest of the episode and the information that I'm going to present and discuss today. Now, while the Americans were arguing about machines and magazines, something much more important was happening behind the Iron Curtain. And the Soviet Union, East Germany, Bulgaria, Romania, the Eastern Bloc countries, you probably are familiar with the Eastern Bloc aspect of strength and conditioning if you've been in this field any time, they treated sport as a national priority. State-funded sports science institutes, teams of researchers working directly with their Olympic athletes, access to populations of elite athletes that Western coaches could only dream of if we're really thinking about it. And out of that system came the foundational texts of modern strength and conditioning that we all know. One of them was Leonid Matyev, often called the father of periodization. He formalized the concept of organizing training into cycles. So things as microcycles, mesocycles, macrocycles, with planned variations in volume and intensity over time. If you've ever written a training block, you're using Matyev's framework, whether you really realize it or not. You're taking a lot of stuff from Matyev. Then we also have Yuri Verkhansky, who pioneered what he called the shock method, which in the West became known as plyometrics. He published detailed analysis of how to develop explosive power in athletes. So the depth jump, contrast training, the concept of special strength. Verkhansky is arguably the most important figure in power development research of the 20th century. And we all know the good book that you will also recognize as well in terms of super training and science and practice of strength training, right? Those are all texts that are coming back into some of this realm here in this Eastern Bloc stuff. We also had Vladimir Zatorsky, who wrote the Science of Practice of Strength Training, as I just mentioned, but it brought a massive amount of Eastern European knowledge into English. And so if you're a strength coach and you haven't read that book, I'm telling you right now, you need to go buy it, read it. It belongs in every coach's shelf next to Super Training by Mel Siff, who is the original author of that book as well. And then we also have Tudor Bompa, a Romanian originally, but he brought periodization to North America and wrote the textbooks that are still used in university strength and conditioning programs today. I have several Tudor Bompa books. They are great. I reference them relatively frequently when it comes to seasonality and sports training. I think Tudor Bompa is definitely a person that you should be knowing or reading if you're writing training programs. And this is also the area where the Institution of Strength and Conditioning Coaching actually forms in the United States. We know it now as the NSCA, or the National Strength and Conditioning Association, founded in 1978. And then we had the CSCS certification that ended up launching in 1985. And then suddenly being a strength coach was now a profession with a credential and a body of literature behind it with a lot of science. And here's the thing that I think should make every coach and trainer really pay attention to this, is that a huge percentage of what gets rebranded and sold on social media as cutting edge programming, whether it be block periodization, conjugate method, contrast training, velocity-based training, is essentially refined versions of work that was done in Eastern Europe between the 1960 and 1990. So none of this is really all that new. It's not revolutionary. It's already been figured out by people much smarter than myself and the majority of the coaches that are implementing it. You just have to know where to find these books and these text messages, and how to sift through them and read them. And some of them do read a little bit hard. They read like textbooks. Again, they are genuine pieces of information that you use to learn and actually absorb knowledge. It's not watered down. It was just directly translated over. And these are all books that I recommend the undergrads read. They at least sift through. They get familiar with. They're texts that you can buy and you will reference for the rest of your career if you really want to use them. Now, this brings us to roughly 2010 to today. And I'm going to call this area that we're currently in when it comes to the strength and conditioning, fitness and performance realm, more of an evidence-based era, because that's really the best term. That's what has happened since about 2010. And here's what has overall changed. For the first time, we had a critical mass of researchers, coaches, and educated lifters who all had internet access and a shared vocabulary. So we had peer-reviewed papers. They weren't locked in like university libraries anymore. You can just access them online. PubMed is free. YouTube has made it possible for sharing coaching cues globally. And there's a generation of researchers who have came along who were also lifters themselves, who cared about practical application, not just publishing and putting their name behind a paper and saying, this is what I found, so I've researched this the way it should then be done. I think a blend of that is fantastic, and it really makes it more relatable and more consumable and usable, especially from a coaching perspective, if you're not just in the research side of things. Brad Schoenfeld has led a huge body of people into the hypertrophy research. I think he's one of the best names to know when it comes to that. From training frequency, volume, rep ranges, rest intervals, exercise selection, he and his colleagues have published dozens of papers and meta-analysis that have reshaped how we program for muscle growth. And the short version here is that volume is probably the most important variable for hypertrophy within a reasonable intensity range. Frequency matters less than the total volume, and ranges from about 5 reps to 30 reps can all produce hypertrophy if taken close enough to failure. None of that was settled in science 20 years ago, right? Even when, you know, I graduated in 2011 from Purdue, and we had our standard hypertrophy range, strength range, endurance range, right? That's, some of that stuff is probably still being taught in academia. And Schoenfeld has shown that, you know, as long as you're at 5 up to 30, as long as you're closing your post failure, really they're all hypertrophy ranges. Now, Eric Helms gave us the evidence-based coaching movement and the muscle and strength pyramids, which is a practical hierarchy for programming decisions. And Mike Isretel and the Renaissance Periodization crew have popularized volume landmarks and names. You got your MEV, your MAV, your MRV, right? The idea that every muscle has a minimum effective, a maximum adaptive, and a maximum recoverable volume. So you've got all these different things you talk about, but we've got some different ranges here that we can now work with. Greg Knuckles and the Stronger by Science team has made research accessible with articles that actually explain what studies mean, and more importantly, and I think this is the big takeaway here, is that they don't mean what they mean, right? It's very clear cut and dry, which makes it great for the average person to not to dig through the research and try to come to the conclusions. They've kind of done all that for us and have given us really this nice clean cliff note in how we might be able to apply it in our field or in our own training. Now, Stuart Phillips did foundational work on protein intake and muscle protein synthesis that underpins modern nutrition recommendations. We've got Chad Wesley Smith and Juggernaut brought practical performance coaching into the conversation here as well. Now, meanwhile, the technology to measure training in real time has also caught up. We've got velocity-based training, which I've talked quite a bit about recently. So using bar speed to auto-regulate your intensity. We've moved from the elite sport into everyday gym use with that material and that usage, which is awesome, right? That used to be something you could only go get in the sports science lab or in the strength and conditioning room, maybe at the high tier levels of sport, but now you can just walk into a gym with your own unit, which is something crazy to think about. We've also got more RPE-based programming and reps in reserve, which gives us way to auto-regulate without needing a one rep max to test every single week. The concept of auto-regulation itself, so adjusting your training based on your daily readiness, has become very mainstream. Now, I do want to be honest, because I do think this is important, that this era has its problems as well. And a lot of evidence-based content on social media is usually cherry-picked. A lot of coaches wave around citations, sometimes of things they've never even read. We've got researchers with supplement lines and coaching products have obvious conflicts of interest there. And meta-analysis can mask individual variation. So being evidence-based doesn't mean you automatically get the right answer. It means you have a framework for asking better questions at the end of the day. But on that, this is the best era strength training has ever been in. We know more about how to build muscle, develop strength, and improve performance than any other point in history when it comes to strength training and strength conditioning. And most of that knowledge is actually free, right? You can get on your cell phone, you can go watch a YouTube video, you can get on TikTok, you can get on Instagram, you can DM some of these people and they might message back to you. You can probably shoot them an email, right? There's lots of ways to not only network and gather the information, but there's also ways to absorb the information and make it readily available. Think about back probably in like the 50s or 60s, you couldn't have did all that. You would have had to like get on a phone, call somebody, get in a car, get in the train and travel and actually talk to the person in person to actually see what was going on or get behind the studies or actually drive to the library and look things up old school. We don't have to do that anymore. We can all do it just from the little device in our pocket. So where does this all go next? And I think there's four trends here that I think we should really pay attention to. Number one is that individualization through data. Wearables keep getting better. They keep improving. We've got continuous glucose monitors. We've got HRV devices. We've got things that track our sleep. We have force plates that are going to cost, you know, $30,000 or so and are now coming down to just the thousands of dollars. We've got our bar speed trackers that can just cost a couple hundred bucks going back to that VBT. And over the next 10, 15, 20 years, coaches are going to have individual level data on every athlete they train in real time continuously. I think that's somewhere this is going, that the programs of the future aren't going to be written for a team. They're going to be adjusted for each and every individual person with every day based on their measured of readiness and how their training needs to reflect that. Number two is we've got AI-assisted programming. And I want to be very careful and cautious here because there's a lot of hype behind this. AI is not going to replace good coaches. It is just not. This is a in-person, personable, and personality-based skill set. And there's something to be said about connecting one-on-one with an individual that a computer or a computer program or AI is not going to be able to replicate in our field. It can't watch a squat in real time and know why it breaks down, right? It can't pick up on a kid's body language and know that something's wrong at home or something happened with a girlfriend or they had a hard test. It's not going to be able to do that kind of stuff. But AI is going to be an incredible assistant coach. That's the way that I'm going to look at it. Pattern recognition across thousands of athletes, program generation based on constraints, equipment that you have, time, things like that. Video analysis for different movement screenings. And if you're a coach and you're not experimenting with these tools right now to some degree or using them to help assist you in small tasks, I do think in the next 3 to 5 years, you're going to find that you are behind the curve. And I want to give a big shout out to my guy, Paul Need. He's a great mentor, a friend, somebody I really respect. And he has done a great job of showing how to implement AI in the field and still have a very successful business. And he's a great coach. Number three is recovery science as the new frontier. So we've been obsessed with training for 100 years now, right? And the next 100 is probably going to be more about recovery. sleep optimization, nutrient timing, heat and cold exposure, which, you know, by the way, research on cold plunging post-workout is still very mixed to, hey, you probably shouldn't do it. Probably should do it away from your training. So, you know, don't buy all those expensive tubs based on Instagram marketing that you're seeing. But we have also got blood flow restriction training, red light therapy, peptides are becoming very popular, very hot topic right now in the fitness industry. And a lot of this, I think, is going to get studied more rigorously. And a lot of it is going to turn out not to work as well as the marketing is making it seem. But I still think some of it will stick and we'll find ways that we can use some of these in very small specific doses, but it could be very beneficial for the very genetic elite. You know, talking about Olympians and pro level athletes, and it will trickle downstream for the average person as well. And number four is going to be genetic and biomarker driven individualization. So we're not far from routine testing that tells you your fiber type distribution, your injury risk profile, your likely response patterns to different training stimuli. I think that's all going to change how we program for elite athletes first, and then it'll trickle down again to the general population coaching, kind of like some of the science recovery stuff that I talked about. I think you're going to see it tested on those people. It's going to make more sense from a monetary perspective to have them use it, really get the last ounce of performance out of every single one of those individuals. And then what's of use and viable will become down to people like you and me. And here is the prediction that I'm going to make on record for you guys as listeners, is that the coaches who win, I think, over the next decade are going to be the ones that can integrate all of this without losing the core principles of the fundamentals, right? You can have the best wearable data in the world and still need to teach how to do a good squat, a good bench press, a good clean, a good deadlift. I think those are all things that are important, but the technology is not going to be able to take that away from the human element side. You can have AI writing your programs, and you still need to build rapport at the end of the day with the 17-year-old kid who's scared of coming into the weight room for the first time to improve their performance and stay healthy and strong and improve their athletic performance, right? I think the technology is clearly going to get better, as it always does in almost any industry. I think strength and conditioning is of no difference, but the human skills are going to remain the deciding factor at the end of the day of not only how they're implemented, but getting the most out of them, and then having the genuine connection with the people as well. Because as we use our cell phones and our laptops, our headphones, as you're listening to this podcast or, you know, watching over on YouTube, that the human element side is getting lost in communication. And there are people that genuinely, especially from a mental health perspective, but also from a performance perspective, they need another living, breathing, in the flesh person next to them, not only to hold them accountable, but to give them real in-person life guidance, feel connected with, have understanding, help them make decisions, right? Those constant communications that happen back and forth in my facility are what drives my business, right? You know, it would be awesome. Hypothetically, it would be awesome. I wouldn't agree with it, but it would be hypothetically awesome if I could just give everybody their training program with all this information, all this data, everything's coming from their cell phone, and I never had to step foot on the training room floor, right? I just sat back, I watched videos, I gave people stuff back, but people don't want to do that. And I don't blame them. I wouldn't want to do that. So the in-person side of it, paired with the technology and having the understanding of how to use it, how to make the decisions both in the moment of the programming from a personal perspective and in the future when you adjust the sessions or you adjust the training or you make new training blocks or you're implementing new exercises, right? I think that's all very important of where this is really trying to go here in the future. And here's where I want to land this plane on this episode. That strength training is definitely not new, okay? The principle of progressive overload is actually about 2,500 years old when we go back to talking about Milo. The concept of periodization itself is at least 60 years old. The modern hypertrophy science is only 15 years old. And so the most of what gets sold as revolutionary on your social media feed, on Instagram, on TikTok, on YouTube, is somewhere between a rebranded old idea and then a real improvement on that idea, but rarely a brand new invention. And I want to be clear and repeat myself here. The majority of what you're seeing on social media is just a rebranded, cleaned up, polished, presentable, marketing-based ideology of an old ideology, right? They're taking something that we've known for quite some time that we know that works, and it's just got all these flashy gizmos and gizmos and how they do all the editing and all that kind of stuff, and it makes it easy to consume. It's in a short form content that we know that the attention spans are decreasing. So the ability to get a lot of information out in a short, snappy 3 seconds to get you to continue to stop the scroll, stop the feed, and then actually pay attention to it, right? There's a lot more marketing to that where there's other people out there that are putting out really freaking good content, but they just are not the marketing type. I like to think of myself as one of those people. I'm not good at marketing at all. I do like to think I put out some pretty good content, but getting those people to stop and to absorb it, but they're not really giving you anything all that new. I think Brad Schoenfeld's probably the best at this because he's actually in the research and doing it. And when he discovers stuff, he shares it and tries to make it applicable and practical to what we need in our field. And I think that's important. But I don't think there's really all that new, brand new intervention or inventions that are coming that we have right now that we've not really known about. But also you'll notice that things come in cycles and waves. And this is something I talked to Dave Tate about years ago now, was that you'll see on social media certain things come and go in waves of popularity. You know, a very big popular one was the high cable row or high lat pull down, how that lets the lat gets long. It's the most optimal lat pull down you can do. And then it moved to the single arm lat pull down. Then you'll see stuff going into the favors of like the compression expansion model being very popular, and that's being all you need to improve range of motion. And you know, there's different waves of how things go. And like I said, it's almost always in the gray of that white to black scale. There's always some good stuff that's come out that's new, that's somewhat beneficial, but at the same time, it's also sometimes using principles that we've already known about. So take everything you watch with a grain of salt, look back and think, hey, is this stuff that we've already known about that we can use a little bit later and that we've known about for a long time that we can use sparingly or in certain positions? Very likely. More likely what you're seeing on social media is not anything brand new, brand spanking new. I assure you that. I do think that knowing the history gives us a filter, right? It gives us a timeline. It gives us the confidence to look at the next breakthrough that somebody's selling or marketing, and lets us be able to ask, is this actually new or is this Matveyev repackaged, right? Is this research back, what they're presenting or showing, or is this bro science just dressed up in a lab coat, all right? You know, they're trying to present it new, but it's really just bro science of the day. We don't have anything to support what maybe they're saying. And so if you're a coach, a trainer, an athlete, just like going to the gym, a gym owner, you know, for the coaching side, our job is to be a professional. If you're an athlete or listening to this, your goal is to try to get better and hopefully listen to coaches and trainers and professionals that you can trust and that are actually listening to the research and going with some of the older things, that the things that have been proven, especially over time. And being a professional, at least from a coaching perspective, means that knowing our field's history, the way that a doctor is going to know their medical history, all right? I think we need to read Zatorsky. We need to read Schoenfeld's papers. We need to read the muscle and strength pyramids. We need to study the old weightlifting USA magazines. I've got the old USAPL powerlifting magazines in my office for people to sift through back from the 80s. Some of them are great. We should watch some of the old Arthur Jones footage, right? We need to build this robust framework, and then we can know exactly where all these new things fit with all of the older stuff. Because I think a lot of people don't know some of this older stuff, and they're like, wow, this is revolutionary, but really, if you know the older stuff, it's really not. And I think this is the uncomfortable truth that we need to talk about, is that most of the industry is still training people the way we did back in 1985, right? The same 3 sets of 10, the same body part splits, the same bench press bro Monday. Everybody in the gym is doing chest day on Monday. Go into your YMCA or your local gym at 4 or 5 o'clock PM and see how many people are still bench pressing on Mondays. Right? They're not using any kind of periodization. There's no auto regulations or training. They try to freaking max out their bench press every Monday, and they are still benching 225, not to their chest, right? I guarantee you, you walk into the gym in America today, you're still going to see those people doing that. They've got no attention to the volume amount of work they're doing. You're going to have people that are doing a shit ton, and they're wasting their time for majority of their training sessions. And you've also got people that are hardly doing enough to even bother with walking into the gym for, right? They'll bench press, and then they'll jabber jaw the rest of the time. So nothing from the last 30 years of research is being applied in these situations either. And those people are going to keep getting beaten by the coaches or the athletes who are actually doing the work of staying current in terms of the not only the research, but also what's going on in the industry. And we do want to make sure that, and from a coaching perspective, that we are the coaches that are still doing the work and still trying to learn and educate ourselves. I'm very passionate about continuing education. I think if you know me, you know that's very much the case. At the end of the day, that's why I put out content, is because I try to learn stuff. I try to pass it on. I do believe that there's three ways that you learn. And I talk to all my interns about this, and we make sure we implement this into our curriculum of our internship, is that, you know, step number one as an intern is you're here to observe and learn. So there's an observing period, right? You are watching me and my wife do our job every day and what that standard looks like and how we deliver, how we speak, how we communicate. I think that's incredibly important. I also like to make sure that we assign them things to read or educate themselves on. Now, sometimes we'll let them pick, like, hey, if you ask me, why are you using bands and chains? Well, guess what? I'm going to send you an article of how bands and chains work and the practicality of how we're going to use them in a strength and conditioning setting. Why are they important? You need to read and learn that. You got to do a little bit of homework, right? I'm not just going to give you the answer. Yes, I might be your supervisor, but the goal is for you to actually have to go dig and find the research and do the reading and learn on yourself. Because when you're invested in it, you're going to be more passionate and you're actually going to want to know and learn more and you're going to retain it. And then it all comes full circle when we do our weekly meeting, is that they now have to present and do something, okay? Ideally, it should stem back on the article that they read. And so not only did they ask the question, they maybe seen the bands and chains used in the gym, now they went and did the research on it. They found out how it works, what the difference are between the bands and chains, why you might use them, how much you use, you know, all that stuff, yada, yada. But now you're going to tell me about it, right? Pretend like I'm the idiot that does not know what bands and chains are, and make me understand why I would pick bands or chains over bands, how much I should be using, how to set them up, right? That is the goal. And I believe when you do all three of those things from a learning perspective, that you truly actually learn about that particular topic, right? And you will probably remember it for a very long time because you immerse yourself in different ways of learning how to absorb the information, both seeing it in person, doing the research, doing the homework, deliver homework, and then having to do enough of that to understand it to tell somebody else. And so that's why I believe that. That's why I give back in my education side and my content for coaches and athletes and whoever chooses to listen and absorb my content, is that I believe that when I present information, I'm able to absorb and learn stuff and remember stuff as well. And that makes me a better coach at the end of the day. I try to speak on things that I know the most of. Obviously, it's like more of a history lesson. So I had to do some more of my homework and where I wanted to take this. But all these names and things I presented today, all the texts and things that I brought up are all things that I am familiar with and have either used or read or know the people personally. You know, you go back to like Louis at Westside or Dave Tate, right? I've got so much from them. I think that's important. And so for being a coach, I think at the end of the day, you should figure out a way to use all three of those. I'm not saying you have to have an intern and do it that way, but I do think it's a great way to make sure that you stay on top of the field and where you need to be. So that's going to wrap today's episode. A little bit of a quicker one for sure. I really appreciate you listening to the Thirst for More podcast. If this episode hit home for you, do me a favor, share with a coach, a friend, a colleague, a trainer, an athlete, somebody that just loves lifting heavy shit. I really appreciate that. And then also, if you can, please leave a rating over on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Give it a thumbs up on YouTube. If you're over there listening on the YouTubes, leave a comment as well. All that stuff helps the show reach the more people that I would like to get my information in front of and have good quality conversations and help educate other people and be all around the right people as well. You can also always just shoot me a DM over on Instagram at bsmitley, and you can interact with me there. I'm also very open in my DMs. You can also let me know if you're leaving comments or whatever, what era of the strength training history that you particularly like. Maybe you took something away that you didn't know anything about. I like to hear where people are at. Personally, I really like that golden era of bodybuilding. I love the whole Arnold Schwarzenegger, Franco Colombo, right? Pumping iron kind of stuff. That stuff's great. And obviously, I'm biased towards Westside Barbell, Libby Simmons, Dave Taylor, FTS. That's always going to hold a special place in my heart as well. Late 90s, early 2000s, as I was coming up in through that area through undergraduate school, and those are obviously people that have shaped me. So, you know, those are the two that I definitely drift towards. But you can even go back to ancient Greece. I did name my son after a Titan. So, you know, there is that as well, that I try to keep some historical content there as well, I guess, at the end of the day. So, but if you do want more deeper dive information, there's more stuff in the show notes as well. I've got all that down there in there for you to be able to check some extra stuff out if you want to check them out. As always, thanks for tuning in to the episode. I really appreciate it. Keep striving to do more, and I'll see you at the next episode. Thanks for listening to Thirst for More podcast. Make sure you give us a follow on Spotify, iTunes, or anywhere else you like to consume your podcast. You can also check us out on YouTube at The Smitley, where you'll find clips and lots of educational-based material for strength and conditioning and exercise science. You can also make sure you give me a follow on Instagram at bsmitley or at Team Thirst, which is my gym Instagram page. For any more future updates on episodes to come, you can make sure you follow me there. I'm your host, Brandon Smitley. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll catch you at the next episode.